Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that. My mind is going. I can feel it.
Full Circle Sidepod, Episode 3. For Sunday, August 29, 2010. Where's the neurotic numbat? In this episode, with great power comes a great utility bill.
Hello world, and welcome to the Full Circle Sidepod. We're maybe halfway through our summer recess from the Full Circle podcast, so this is either goodbye to Season 1, or hello and welcome to Season 2. In our layoff, Dave Wilkins has been to Portugal, when he hasn't been in Spain, Ed has been to Croatia, and I've been to Shepperton, which is next to a reservoir under the Heathrow Airport flight path. I haven't really got this vacation thing, have I? We'll try to keep this a lightweight show. I thought I'd do a roundup of some news items that caught my eye during the break. There's the interview I recorded with Matt Grove from Granola, and I'll talk a little bit more about editing the podcast.
The Full Circle podcast is the companion to Full Circle magazine, the independent magazine for the Ubuntu community. Find us at www.fullcirclemagazine.org/podcast.
Sidepod News.
If you missed it, Mr. Shuttleworth has announced the codename for Ubuntu 11.04, the one with the double N mnemonic. I must say I'm disappointed. Again, come on. Where's the neurotic numbat? The numbat is a real and endangered marsupial, Myrmecobius fasciatus. Check the show notes, and don't say that we're not educational. In other news, with the white heat of technology, it looks like product life cycles are getting shorter and shorter. Item 1. The Microsoft Kin phone is cancelled after a month. Microsoft has decided to kill off the Kin, the two Microsoft non-branded phones targeted at teenage users. This after little more than a month. Okay, it only launched in the US, but it proved such a disaster, Microsoft have unceremoniously killed it in the hope that we'll all forget about it by the autumn. Redmond also assumes that since Kin was the brand and didn't mention Microsoft, that nobody knows it was their screw-up. Why did it fail? Maybe it was the cockeyed marketing. Maybe it was the complete lack of teenage cool. Or maybe it was the ludicrously expensive capped data plan that nobody underneath a graduate salary could actually afford. You decide. Item 2. Google Wave RIP. Google has announced it is ending development on Wave, its cross-platform communication tool, launched with much fanfare at the Google I/O Developer Conference in May 2009. Google said, "Wave has not seen the adoption we would have liked," and that elements of Wave's technology, including the drag-and-drop and character-by-character real-time typing, are now opened up to open source, so that users can liberate their content from Wave. Since we're being encouraged by Google's Eric Schmidt to celebrate our failures, perhaps we should all have a little wake for Wave. Perhaps instead of celebrating, he'd like to tell us how the damn thing was supposed to work in the first place. Okay, I'm kidding. I understand how it works, and a lot of people admired the technology. The trouble with Wave is that it only really works with a small group of collaborators. Otherwise, the multi-threaded conversation turns into a complete noise and nobody can follow what the hell is going on. Let's see what they make of Google Buzz with its progress in a few months' time. in our next news, everybody sues everybody else. It seems nobody develops software or manufactures hardware anymore. Everybody just sues everybody else. And here's two more examples. Lexmark is undertaking yet another attempt to block third-party cartridge makers. Instead of invoking the DCMA, they got clever this time, and they're claiming patent violations. Back in the early 2000s, Lexmark filed a similar lawsuit against manufacturers of a chip, which allowed third-party cartridge makers to have their products work in Lexmark printers. That time, Lexmark invoked the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and eventually lost the case in 2005. Since patent suits seem to be all the rage, they're having another go. Our second big lawsuit is from Paul Allen's Interval Research Corporation. Interval Research, which was a real research lab until it went bust, is now suing everybody in Silicon Valley. Apple, Google, Facebook, eBay. Really, it might be quicker to list who they're not taking to court. There are four patents, which all revolve around three main concepts. Browser use for navigating through information, managing a user's peripheral attention whilst using a device, and alerting users to items of current interest, which seems to be most of the things that we do while we're on the internet. So that's searching for information and presenting the results alongside related news articles or media, status updates from friends, or real-time data notification such as stock tickers or the weather. So put it another way, Interval Research believe that every time you get a pop-up stock quote, a suggestion for related reading near a news article, a recommendation of a similar product on a shopping site, or a related video down the side of the screen, you're violating one of their patents. Now, I'm no patent lawyer, but surely any idiot in a suit could point to these patent dates, which are all between 2004 and 2008, and point to prior art going back to the 1990s. Oddly, Interval Research isn't suing anybody in Washington State, so no Microsoft or Amazon. Perhaps Mr. Allen is embarrassed to sue people that he might see at his yacht club. Next news. Intel is buying McAfee, in a move which nobody seems to understand. In the single most ridiculous deal this year, Intel is buying McAfee for something like $7.6 billion, yes, that's billion with a B, which equates to $48 a share, which is a premium of over $18 on the last closing price before the deal. That values McAfee at something like 45 times its earnings, when even Apple trades at only 20 times earnings. And nobody so far has made a rational case for it. However, if you take the biggest PC chip maker and add a big dose of so-called security expertise, I can only surmise that more on-chip digital rights management is on the way. So that probably means more lockdown or DRM in more future hardware. I'm not going to go into the whole Google-Verizon deal on net neutrality, or put it another way, Google and Verizon destroying net neutrality, because another interesting story came out, which is Google Voice calls have been added to Gmail. Starting August 25th, you can now call any phone right from Gmail, but only if you're in the US. Although apparently some people in the UK have got it to work as well. This is a very interesting challenge to the telecoms companies and Skype. Google says that calls to the US and Canada will be free throughout 2010, and international calls are billed at, quote, insanely low rates. You can check out the rate card, which we'll link in the show notes, and decide for yourself how insanely low they are. What's interesting in this one is that in using internet technology to carry VoIP phone calls, Google is now setting itself up as a rival to the US long-distance carriers. Those are the same carriers that have seen their business chewed up by Skype and Vonage and a few other voice over IP carriers. We'll wait and see what those guys do by way of response. And another step closer to the complete regulation of the internet, Philadelphia levies the $300 blog tax. The city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, has levied its business privilege tax on residents that engage in, quote, activity for profit. Activity that includes blogging, provided a user's blog runs adverts or makes money in other ways. The business privilege tax requires residents to pay a privilege license for a one-time fee of $300 or $50 annually, and that's in addition to a 4.45% of gross receipts and or taxable net income. The problem is, this license technically applies to any person conducting business activity in Philadelphia, regardless of that activity's profit or loss margins. So if you're an amateur blogger who makes $10 or $12 a year from AdSense, then you're required to pay 6.45% of that in income tax. And that's in addition to the license, which in this case would vastly exceed the revenue generated by your blog. The only good news so far is that they've only caught up with the people who've included their blog revenue on their tax return. Now, as I understand it, tax avoidance is legal, whereas tax evasion is not. We would never advocate that. Next, more MPEG-LA news. The MPEG Licensing Authority has declared that the H.264 codec is to be royalty-free in perpetuity. This is clearly an attempt to sync Google's newborn WebM VP8 codec. Unfortunately, the legal status of H.264 is still as clear as mud. There's nothing to stop the MPEG-LA changing its mind later on and levying license fees on any use of it. Any form of commercial use still requires paying money to the MPEG-LA, even to the extent that carrying an advert on your website, which also happens to host an H.264 video, is technically in breach of the license. And since the MPEG-LA has already stated that they're willing to go after individual end users, H.264 is the codec equivalent of an anti-personnel landmine. Just be careful where you tread, guys. And finally, Facebook entries are admissible as evidence in divorce cases. Beware what you post on your social networking site, as whatever you post to your profile could be used against you in a court of law by your ex-partner when the divorce case comes around. According to a detailed report from the Associated Press, social networks are a new favourite source of information for divorce attorneys. Our web-based oversharing is yielding a wealth of personal information about our dating lives, party habits, attitudes, and financial status. Particularly if you're bitching about your ex or posting saucy pictures of you frolicking with your secretary on a beach when you're supposed to be at a conference. Unreasonable behaviour? Does 98 hours a week logged on Farmville or Warcraft count? Allegedly, the word Facebook alone appeared in around 20% of one law firm's cases last year. It just confirms what I keep saying. The Homo geekus species has no concept of a self-edit button. By the way, can anyone tell me how easy it is to fake up evidence on some of these sites? I only ask because none of the judges appear to know the answer when they admit this evidence either.
Sidepod interview.
Energy-saving computing. It's a neat concept, saving you money by saving you electricity. That's money off your utility bill while you do your bit to save the planet. Granola is software that improves the energy efficiency of your PC or laptop. A few weeks ago, I spoke to Matt Grove from Granola, who explained how it works. And our next guest is Mr. Matt Grove from Miserware. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Very good. And I suppose the first thing to start off with is, who or what is Miserware, and where does Granola fit into the software line?
Sure. So Miserware is a green IT software company. It's a startup, so it was founded in 2007, and it's a spin-out from Virginia Tech in Virginia in America. And there was a professor there who has been doing research into high-performance computing and energy-saving computing for about 10 years, and he started a company to try and turn some of his research into software that people can actually use on their computers. And the company that he founded is Miserware. And the main bit of software that we are showing off at the moment is Granola, which is a little program for PCs, laptops, or servers that will try and save you energy without you having to turn your machine off or change the way that you use computers.
This is becoming a concern for a lot of people, that the PC industry is now selling hundreds of millions of machines a year. The CO2 bill seems to be going up. Whether or not you believe in the hard science of climate change, I'm slightly skeptical. Maybe we've caught one of those cyclical temperature raises in Earth's atmosphere, but one way or the other, 6 billion of us on the planet are certainly not going to help it, and we may well accelerate the damage that we could do, which is, where does granola come into helping us reduce the damage?
Well, apart from the climate change argument, there are two things that you can say as facts. So the cost of electricity is going up. So that is happening around the world. And as you said, there are more computers. So more computers consuming more electricity means that it's costing people a lot more money. So that's one thing to consider alongside the green aspect. At the end of the day, if you can reduce the amount of electricity that a computer is using, then you are going to cut down your energy bill just for powering the computer, but you also will cut down your energy bill for having to cool your computer, having to cool your facilities with all of your computers in them if they are a data center. So the electrical bill, if you stop thinking about just your computer that sits in your desk and blow that up into the data centers that someone like Google has, is astronomical. There's a huge amount of electricity. And when people build their data centers these days, they have to put them next to power stations to be able to supply enough electricity. So we're not talking about tiny little bits of energy or just plugging your one computer into the national grid. We're talking about giant power stations powering millions of computers around the world. So there's a huge amount of electricity going into running the internet and running all of the machines that are plugged into it. So this is not a trivial amount of electricity. And it takes a huge amount of energy to produce all of that electricity.
And it's 24/7. We switch them on, and so many of them never get turned off or powered down. It's just constant.
Sure. I think in the more geeky world, people tend to leave their desktop computers on, whereas less geeky people tend to turn them off. Now, turning your computer off is the best way to save electricity. But at the same time, there are plenty of people that want to have their computers doing things when they're not sitting at them. And a data center with a bunch of web servers in it is a good example of that. No one's going to really want to turn their web server off in case it needs to serve a web page. So there are plenty of machines out there that we don't really have the choice. So they have to stay on. And the clever bit about what Miserware does is we make software that means you don't have to turn your computer off to save electricity. And that's the big change. There are people that have tried to do things like this before. But what normally happens is you compromise some of the performance of the machine in order to provide that energy saving. And what we do is be much cleverer about how we save you the energy so that we don't impact the performance of the machine, but we try and save you some electricity. And that's the real big difference. And that's where the 10 years of research from Virginia Tech comes into play. This isn't something that somebody came up with overnight. This took a long time to figure this kind of stuff out.
I was going to say that this isn't a new idea of trying to reduce the power consumption, but most of the solutions that have been out and around for the last 10 years or so, most of the data center people just throw them out because of the impact on the machines and the performance. What's the secret?
Sure. The big difference between what we do and what other people are doing, if you look at only people who are trying to save you energy while the machine is on, so let's forget about turning computers off for a minute. The big difference between Miserware and what other people are doing is the way that we choose how much power to use. So what our software is doing in this version is changing the frequency of your CPU, which I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast knows about. Your CPU can change frequency, and the modern CPU, when it changes frequency, can reduce the amount of electricity that it's consuming. So the lower the frequency, the lower the power consumption, basically. And the other solutions, such as the on-demand driver, have a different way of choosing when to go down frequency. So what we have is a predictive model where we try and predict the future to know how much electricity and what frequency to set the CPU at to give you the performance that you're going to need in the future. That is the intellectual property. That's the very clever bit. The other solutions that people have out there, like some of the open source ones, are threshold-based. And what they do is they sit there at a certain frequency, and when a machine works hard for a certain amount of time and goes over a threshold, it will increase the frequency. And when it's idle for a certain amount of time, it will reduce the frequency. The lag between when you're stuck at your low frequency and doing work before the threshold is reached is your lost productivity. That period while we're waiting to go up a frequency you're losing the performance of your computer. With a predictive one, we've already jumped into the higher frequency by magically knowing that we need to get there. Now, of course, it isn't magic, but that's the secret bit that differentiates us from the other people.
So to run that predictive algorithm, you must be collecting some kind of trend information over time in order to make your predictions.
Yes. So the idea is you look at the utilization of the machine and you feed that into your predictor. Now, the predictor isn't magic, although we'd like it to be perfect, it isn't. So sometimes it makes mistakes. And that what it does when it makes a mistake is it keeps track of when it gets things wrong and when it gets things right. And this allows us to bound the performance loss. So we can do something like, say, whilst you're trying to save energy, you must never lose more than 5% of the performance of this machine. And what will happen is if it starts getting wrong and it gets to the 5% threshold, it will stop bringing the machine into the lower power state until it can guarantee that it's definitely not going to lose you there. So our software is the only one that you can get where you can say, this is what an acceptable performance loss is. And the reason for that is none of the others have a concept of what performance they are losing. So they couldn't guarantee you anything apart from full power, because they have no idea what effect they're having because they don't record it. Whereas it's core to how our predictor works, that it looks at your utilization and keeps track of what it's doing.
You've just released a new version of Granola.
Yeah, last week we released version 3, and Granola is available for Debian 5, Debian Unstable, Fedora 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, Red Hat Enterprise 4 and 5, SLES 10, and Ubuntu 7 all the way through 10. So you can download that for any of those Linux distributions. And we do all of that packaging ourselves. It's also available for Windows, but I don't know how many people listening to this really care about that.
Well, we've got lots of people in mixed environments and a few Macintosh people as well.
Sure. Well, the nice thing is, as well as all of those Linux versions that I said, you can also run this on Windows 7, Windows Vista, and Windows XP. And that's both the server versions of the operating system and the desktop ones as well. So we've pretty much got everybody covered. Not yet got the Apple Mac people done, but it is on the list. There are plenty of people who have been asking for it, so I imagine you'll see that in the future.
Installation on my test box was painless. In fact, I didn't even realize it had finished. It just put everything in that I needed.
We do native packaging for all of the Linux distributions, so we don't do something like give you a tar and then hope that you can install it on your different, you know, your different distro. So if you're installing it on Fedora, you have a native RPM ready for Fedora, and the same for Ubuntu. So we also provide like a lot of people do, we have a repository that you can add. So you can just use normal Synaptic tools to download things, or apt-get if that's what you want to do. So the installation is very painless. We even wrote a shell script that will add the repository to your machine if you don't want to do that. So it's very simple. And to install it on Windows, you just download the executable and double-click on the installer, and it's very painless on both of them. We spent a lot of time and effort trying to package it natively, trying to build software for Linux that installs perfectly on whatever it is, 15 different distributions, both 32-bit and 64-bit. It's not for the faint-hearted, but it's something that we're quite proud of, that we can do that for you.
I was pleasantly surprised to see the number of different package types you had up there. Once you've got it installed and running, what's it like in terms of memory usage and resources that it needs to do its job?
There are two components to the Linux Granola. You have the little daemon that runs in the background all of the time. He's doing the actual power management of your machine. So he's basically changing the frequency of your processor and keeping track of whether recording what it's been doing in a log file and that kind of jazz. And that's a tiny little daemon that was written in C and C++ to be as small as we could possibly get it so that you would never see it. So it's basically transparent and stays out of the way. And certainly I'm running it now on my laptop. If I type top, I can't see Granola on the first page, but I'll do it for you. Yeah. So Skype is right at the top, and then Chrome and some other bits and bobs and my terminal, but there is no, I can't see Granola there. The second bit of the software is the GUI, which is a Python program that we've written that actually has a BSD license, so you can change it and fiddle with it if you so wish. It's completely open source, the GUI part. All that does is take the log files that are coming from the daemon and display them for you in such a way that they make sense. So they'll tell you how much electricity you've been saving, what that translates to in pounds, how much CO2 that is, that kind of stuff. And the big change that we recently made to the software is if you would like it to, it can upload those numbers to the Granola website. And if you use the same account for multiple machines, it will put all of your savings on one web page for you and do all of the adding up. So if you have a bunch of computers, like a lot of people do these days, you can see all of your savings on one page. And that's something that we are adding more features to every day now. That's really it's useful, but it's also a fun tool for us to use to add the... You'd be surprised what people ask for. Everyone wants to know the details about what their computers are doing. And one of the big differences between Granola and the other power saving tools is their reporting. To be able to actually see what's going on, people really like that. Different people like it for different reasons, but it's been a very positive thing for us to add to the software. And I only see us adding more and more of that kind of stuff to it. So if you're in a corporate environment and you have 1,000 computers, you don't really want to go around and have somebody add them all up. Although we do have someone that has an intern that does that with a piece of paper and a calculator. So you don't have to do that anymore. You can now log on to the website and see what all of your savings are. So that's the big difference. And you'd be surprised how addictive it is sitting there watching your numbers tick up, hitting refresh.
And now that you've got that capability of tracking back, how much and what level of data are you collecting back? Because I imagine that is very useful for refining your predictive algorithms performance measures. But to what level are you interested in what people use their machines for?
Although we don't automatically report it back, we're very interested in all of the different workloads that people run. So the interesting thing for us is everyone's got different things that they do with their computer. And even when your computer's running flat out, there are still ways for us to save energy with our algorithm. So we are very interested to hear from people that have strange uses for their computers, or they have a large number of computers doing something very specific to run Granola and tell us what their savings are, or tell us to have a look for them. If there's anything that we can do to tune the algorithm further for specific people, we are very interested in doing that. So the workload for a PC, for a normal desktop PC that someone runs at home, is very diverse. For starters, the operating system can be completely different. You've got Ubuntu, I don't know, your brother might have Windows 7. That's very different. And you may do completely different things with the computer. So the sky is the limit, really, for profiling the different workloads. And although we run dozens of them in the office, there's nothing quite like being able to talk to people, because there are thousands of people using Granola now, and every single one of them is unique and does something slightly different with their computer. So it's really a team effort to try and dial in the software. Not only is it a team effort to try and improve the software, the more people that run it, we were saying earlier about there being thousands of computers. If everybody runs Granola on their computer, then we're going to drastically reduce the amount of electricity that is used around the whole world for computers. Really, don't think about it just as you installing on your one machine and saving yourself a few pounds a year. Imagine how many trees equivalent you are planting as a team effort with everybody that's installing it. So right now, my website is telling me that the community together has currently done the equivalent of planting 76,544 trees to offset the CO2 that their computers would have generated if they hadn't been running Granola. So the numbers get quite big quite quickly. You know, the compelling thing is the more people do it, the bigger the number gets. Spread the word. Don't think of just yourself using it on your computer. Tell other people about this.
So how large is that community at the moment?
76,000 trees equates to more than 80,000 users. I can't look it up at the moment, but right. More than 80,000 people using it at the moment.
How's that distributed across the planet? I know that
pretty much all over the place now. It was very English to start with, mostly thanks to Alan Pope telling everybody about it. And then we spread across to America, where obviously we are based. And since we opened out from beta and allowed anyone to install it, we have got people from all over the world. And we get lots of requests for translations. And the GUI has, when it tells you how much money you're saving, it has the, originally it had a dollar sign. And then we had all the English people rock up, so we added the pound sign. And now, due to popular demand and a lot of shouting at us, we've added the euro symbol. So we've got requests for pretty much every currency in every language that there is now. So our graphic designer is diligently churning out lots of new icons. So, it's great. It's nice to see how it's spread about the place. It's also interesting having people write about your software in languages that you can't read, and you're wondering what exactly they're saying about you. But it's all been very positive, and we're really happy with the reception that it's had globally now.
If you look at, say you look at a machine profile, can you look at its power consumption and say, oh yes, that's an exchange server, that's somebody sitting on YouTube when they should be working, that's somebody who's just sitting there with OpenOffice?
If we do the profiling, we can figure out what machines are up to. What we normally do with a workload that's like an interesting workload is we will run it ourselves at Miserware on one of our test computers, and we hook them up to power meters. And these aren't like £10 power meters. These are custom built thousands of pounds worth of kit that will do very accurate, very fine-grained reporting on what the computer is up to. And then we do a profile of the utilization and the power consumption and what the software is doing. And we have, in order to get the benchmarking to work, we have to make a repeatable workload that you can do virtually the same thing with every single time, which is actually very difficult. And it makes doing the benchmarking of this kind of software very tricky. There's a lot of things that take a lot of time to set up to try and get accurate readings. But we basically will try and copy your workload and then try and improve things if something weird is going on, or at least try and understand what is happening. But we have everything set up to do that at Miserware. There are documents that describe how to do your own benchmarking, but it's not for the faint-hearted. It's not quite just stick a power meter in the wall and have a look at what's going on. It is quite a serious process.
Yeah, so if you're going to do any kind of proper benchmarking worth having, you've got to be very scientific and very rigorous. That much I know.
So we wrote a PDF to try and help you all. So if you go to the Granola website, there is actually, we did our best to put together a document to try and point everyone in the right direction, or at least give you the benefit of our experience so that you don't have to fight with it quite as much as we have had to over the years.
Okay, and I guess one of the things that everybody's going to ask about is licensing, because I've installed the free and gratis version, which is great. And what else is Granola doing to make some money to keep doing the research and keep developing?
Sure, there is other software that Miserware makes. We have a thing called ServeMiser ES, which is basically a headless version of Granola that's set up for running across large numbers of computers. It's designed to be scalable to the thousands and work within your data center. So that's not free software. That's one of our sold products. The other thing that we're doing now is adding more things to Granola. Now that we've finally got Granola finished and out the door, the idea is to try and add more things that are useful that people keep asking for the sort of enterprise market. So not just the kind of things that we all want Granola to do at home, but the kind of things that somebody with 1,000 desktop computers would like to do. So the daemon and the features that you have at the moment are completely free for you guys to use. The reporting stuff to the website will track up to 5 computers completely for free. And then after that, when you start getting into the large numbers of machines, we would talk to you about a site license for the software so that you could run it on all of your computers and get your support, and a typical sort of sales model where the support is really the thing that you're paying for.
And do you want to just give out the website address, which I think is a really clever little address, actually?
So the software is called Granola. And the domain name is grano.la. So it is the word granola, but with a dot between the O and the L. And Laos sold all of their domain names to the city of LA. And that's where all those domain names are. The easiest way to find Miserware is just type Miserware into Google, and you'll be presented with a whole page of results for us.
Once I'd heard about Granola, I didn't even have to think about what the address is. I just remembered grano.la, and it's straight there. Thank you very much, Matt. That's hopefully given some people something to think about. Knowing the Ubuntu community like I do, none of them seem to be averse to saving a bit of cash. So maybe we can save some money and save some of the planet in the process. It was very apposite for me because I just went and paid my utility bill this lunchtime.
Well, that's
which
the
is
bottom
always
line, isn't
painful
it?
Experience. Oh, painful every time. I'll keep running the new version. I might even try and get it on all the machines here. Let's see what the saving adds up to. Okay, very good.
Okay. Well, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Contribute. The Full Circle podcast, like the magazine, is nothing without the contributions of the Ubuntu community. If you want to join us, want to suggest ideas for news, opinions, reviews, Creative Commons music tracks, or just want to give us a pat on the back, contact us at podcast@fullcirclemagazine.org.
Expert Spot.
Editing the Full Circle Podcast, Part 3, The Edit Environment. And my edit environment is a thing called Audacity. It's a multi-tracking audio editor. I have a confession, this may not be the best tool for this job. It's certainly not foolproof or bombproof. It can occasionally crash, but I've found it has the best crash recovery routines of any software I know. The thing with Audacity, it works, I like it, I'm used to it. Audacity in practice. Following the recording, I'll do a first pass edit, which means I'll edit each recorded segment separately, and that means cutting up my master recordings into the segments of the podcast. Whenever I'm editing, I save the new project immediately before I even start to do anything so that Audacity can create its working folders. Make sure you've got plenty of disk space free. Audacity works with uncompressed audio, which will chew up a lot of disk space. My general rules from here: save projects often, don't do more than a handful of edits without saving, and avoid rework, as it's generally your enemy. Here's a question: to compress or not to compress? MP3 is a compressed audio format. It's lossy, so when you write out an MP3, it applies a compression algorithm and it throws away some of the bits. If you want to re-edit that, you can't put those bits back in, and you'll have some loss of quality. So if you make edits in compressed formats, then start cutting and pasting them together, mixing, rendering, and then export them as compressed formats, your audio quality is likely to be shot by the end. So I take the original files and convert them to an uncompressed format such as FLAC before I start editing. File naming. Unless you're using Git or some other version control framework, you're going to have to institute your own tracking and versioning. All my working file names follow some kind of pattern, such as the episode name, the edit date, and some kind of qualifier to indicate what stage of the project I'm at. For example, I'll have episode 7, 2205.10 for the date, and maybe raw at the end to indicate I haven't really done the edits yet. Once I have an edited version for length and content, I might call it episode 7, 2205.10, edit. Then if I move on to applying my filters, effects, and other post-processing, I'll save it out to episode 7, 2205.10, edit, processed. I periodically export my edits to an interim file, just in case I want a macro level of undoing what I've edited. So I'll get episode 7, 2205.10, edit, interim 1, interim 2, and so on. And I generally save those as uncompressed FLACs. I can delete all of the interim files at the end of the edit. It means I can go as far back as I want, and it gives me some safe copies and a macro level of undo should anything go horribly wrong. Source tracks. I don't actually need stereo for a podcast. I'm not Kraftwerk, panning left to right and using surround sound. It's a vocal podcast, which is fine because through Skype Call Recorder, I get a low sample rate mono OGG file, so I can happily work in mono for the rest of the project. For non-Skype recordings, titles, trailers, music, I go for 44.1 kHz stereo. I can downgrade the sample rate and the quality in the edit, but I can't put back in what wasn't there to start with. I just import these into Audacity, converting stereo to mono when I need to. Just remember, you can't paste stereo into mono because two tracks into one doesn't fit. And remember resampling. I always work with the same sample frequency for all my tracks, which is 44.1 kHz. The editing workspace in Audacity works well if you can expand, collapse, resize, and zoom your tracks at will. Remember that undo is your friend. In the first instance, I usually clean up the audio and use the noise reduction filter to get rid of the background hiss. So if you select a bit of blank recording where no one's speaking, what you'll be listening to is the background hiss or line noise. You run it once to get the noise profile, then select the whole track and repeat it to run noise reduction with the same settings across the whole track. This should take out the hiss. All of our recordings have low signal levels, which is deliberate. I can fix the levels with the amplifier and normalize filters. What I can't do is fix the clipping of a signal that booms past 0 dB. That's when it bounces off the red end of the scale because it's too loud. That's when you get distortion. So if in doubt, record quieter. To enhance our audio, I'll run more or less of the bass boost, pitch shift, and EQ or equalization. That makes up for the Skype quality and the low sample rate. I can use it to artificially fill in the signal and warm up the sound. Tempo changes are usually reserved for Mr. Dave Wilkins, which slows him down to an intelligible level of words per minute. I can selectively apply these filters for segments of audio or across the whole track. Finally, I use the normalize function to normalize the finished track to minus 0.3 dB, which leaves me some headroom and doesn't blow everybody's headphones. The automatic remover. I wish I had one, but sadly, it doesn't exist. Normal speech is littered with pauses, stutters, repetitions, and 400 varieties of and other verbal tics. Sorta, kinda, like, you know, and all those other things that we put into everyday speech. Mainly to cover when we're thinking about what we're actually going to say next. A few occurrences of these you can generally tolerate, but too many of them ruin the listening experience. The human ear tunes into imperfections, making each instance more and more of an irritant. Continuous, coherent speech, however, is a learned skill which too few of us these days seem to learn. So I zoom into the waveform and cut lots of these out. This may sound like hard work, but having edited the same people's speech for a few episodes, I can now read the waveform and spot the verbal glitches. My erms have a very distinctive shape in the waveform that I can zoom in on. Editorial policy. Being a family-friendly show has its issues. We're pretty good, but sometimes unintentionally cross the boundary with a throwaway line. Now, I hate the modern obsession we call political correctness gone mad, and in my private humour, I reserve the right to offend anybody at any time. And I frequently do. But not for the podcast. That means out go swearing, blue jokes, race jokes, religious jokes, minority jokes, disability jokes, and I also try to reduce the Apple bashing, Microsoft bashing, and bashing of the other Linux distros. With these last ones, not because it's discriminatory, but because they're such easy targets, it's like kicking a tramp when he's already down. Content edits. Here's the difficult bit. Making three British guys sound like intelligent experts, or even functioning human beings. Believe me, it's difficult, and you have my sympathy if you have to talk to us face to face. The best radio sounds like a well-formed stream of consciousness. We don't. It's worse than that, because we're unscripted. And, as I've said, most people have a very weak internal edit button. So the next round of edits is for all of the half-lines, incomplete thoughts, halts, and restarts, which all have to go. Dead air. I hate dead air. Almost the last step is to cut all the dead air. For one thing, it wastes airtime. For another, when a speaker pauses for too long, it makes the listener uncomfortable. And when that's in an audio-only broadcast, the listeners think it's broken down and start checking their media player. Do this twice in one show, your listener's probably going to give up and go home. So that step adds to my editing for length, as all the way through this, I'm looking back to make cuts for the final length of the show. I usually apply two criteria. Are we still relevant to the topic? And are we being entertaining? The live discussion segments are unscripted, and even whilst we're recording, I'm on the lookout for rat holes and dead ends in the content. Some of the amusing banter also has to go. See editorial policy. The quality meter also kicks in. If the comments are not intelligent enough, are too obvious, vacuous, or add no value, then they're gone. The trouble is, a lot of our material is technical, and some of it, i.e. the gaming segment, I know absolutely nothing about, which makes editing a little difficult. I have to remember we're pitching to the broad church that is the Full Circle readership, from expert developers through sysadmins to new users on the desktop. And I know we can't please everyone, well, most of the time. Bearing in mind we're mostly a comment show, and therefore opinion-driven, our banter is quite important to keep things lively. That means giving all the participants a share of the airtime, and not letting my natural sarcasm run riot, and not rat-holing the show with exclusively British humour, in-jokes, or tedious personal anecdotes. Well, see editorial policy. By the time I've gone through all of these technical edits and editorial edits, we should end up with something that sounds vaguely like a podcast. So part four is about how we package and distribute each of our shows.
Feedback. You can post comments and feedback on the podcast page at fullcirclemagazine.org/podcast. Send us a comment to podcast@fullcirclemagazine.org. You can also send us a comment by recording an audio clip of no more than 30 seconds and sending it to the same address. Comments and audio may be edited for length. Please remember, this is a family-friendly show.
And that was the Full Circle Side Pod. Bye for now.